We will leverage just about anything to improve our status. Where we live, where we work, what we wear, what we drive, where we went to school, where our kids go to school, what team our kids make, what choir or band or orchestra we play in. We're all about status. And you might say, well, Pastor, that's worldly. We're not like that in the church. Au contraire. The church deals with status too. We can boast about having right belief or the proper spiritual piety, the right gifts, the right relationships, the right position on social issues. I even had someone once boast to me about their spiritual maturity. Just let that sit for a moment. And as you heard from the passage that I just read, humility's been a challenge for the church from the beginning. And it's not only a challenge within the church, the Apostle Paul writes about that, but it's a challenge beyond the church, because for folks who are beyond the church looking at the church, when they don't see humility, they don't want anything to do with us. If you ask people from beyond the church what they think about the church, what they think that people within the church think about them, is two C words, condescension and condemnation. They find us condescending toward their lifestyles, toward their beliefs, toward who they are as people. And correspondingly, they find us condemning of them. If you don't believe about the right God in the right way, tough being you. Now, this is ironic because we in the church ought to be the most humble people anywhere. Not the least. I mean, we ought to be the farthest ones from condescension and condemnation. And the reason is that the one who we follow, the one whose name we profess, was absolutely flat out the most humble people in all of human history. Did I say people? He was the most humble person. I wasn't creating a new trinity there, sorry. And you know, you just heard it. The Apostle Paul writes it. He's in the form of God. Can you get any higher than that? No. And he emptied himself, nothing more to give, and that self-emptying took him to death on the cross, which was the most painful, humiliating, shameful form of death at that time. So we have Jesus who goes from the highest high to the lowest low. He is absolutely the embodiment of humility. How is it then that the church doesn't get there with him? There's this language of self-emptying. Self-emptying. And Jesus empties himself in order that he might embrace all of humanity. The problem, when we're full of ourselves, there's no room for anybody else. If it's all about us, there's no anyone else. People get that. Jesus' self-emptying costs him his life. What might it cost us to empty ourselves even a little bit? What would we give up? Being right, status, ego. The Apostle Paul gets very specific. He says, count others as better than yourselves. It's an attitude. You're not actually doing the evaluation. Well, they're better than me on this, but I'm better than them on that, and overall the weighted average. No, just Put others first. It goes a long way toward embracing humility. And the model is the one who had the farthest to come. Now, Paul mentioned that we're celebrating Helen Palooza today. And if you don't worship at 8 or 9:15, you might not know Helen Alabuni, but she's been our worship and music director for 30 years. And I would have talked about her in this context anyway, but I'm also bringing Steve into it here. This may surprise you, but sometimes church musicians have big egos. Laughs the former organ major. And I don't mean that as a dig. They come by it honestly because they develop a very, very high craft that not everybody can do. And they do it extraordinarily well. And they do it in a setting where people are listening. And then they come to them and they say, "You sing so beautifully. You play so wonderfully. Wow, you're great." So it's a challenge to not let that puff up and create issues. I got to tell you, I've been here not 30 years, but a long time. That's never been an issue here. And the reason is largely because Helen and Steve set the tone where it's not going to be the issue. It's understood that the musicians serve the music. And the music serves the worship. And the worship serves God. And when we get that right, there's no condescension, condemnation, boasting. It's an emptying of self. Last thing on humility. We're not able to just go off and develop it on our own. This is one that can only be cultivated and lived and experienced in community. And so the board and the staff added this value as one of our shared ones at Atonement. So in that prayer, there are four things that Paul is praying for, and on behalf of the church. So when you hear the word "you" there, that's not you singular, that's you collectively. He's praying to God on behalf of the whole church. First, that the church would be strengthened. Second, that it would experience what he calls the indwelling, the living within it, the church, of Jesus himself. That the church would experience the beauty of life together in community. And that they would feel and know the love of Jesus Christ, which is above all knowledge. That's what he's praying for. And then he uses this image of being filled by the presence of God. And he's recalling Old Testament experience where, if you remember, when the people of God were in the wilderness, they didn't have a permanent home. And when they worshiped, they worshiped in a large tent-like structure called a tabernacle. And God was present in the tabernacle. There was physical experience of God's presence in the tabernacle. And then after David made Jerusalem the center of Israel, the religious and the political center of Israel, the temple was built there, not by him but by Solomon. But it's in the temple where God's presence is experienced. And probably the most vivid expression of that in the Bible is in Isaiah, when Isaiah has this vision of God. He talks about the hem of God's robe filling the entire temple. And don't get hung up on the physics of that. Right? So it's that image of being filled by God's presence, which Paul then translates into the new context where there is no more temple as the residence of God. The church is the residence of God. So the filling by God's presence takes place within the church. And you might think of, I think it's fair to think of spiritual growth as an increasing filling by God, ever increasingly filled by God. He also talks about grasping things. He wants the church to get it, to grasp the full measure of God's love. And God's love is absolute. That doesn't change. It's not contingent on whether or not we get it. But our experience of God's love is broader, deeper, longer, more rooted, the more we grasp it. And it seems like we grasp it over time, that our life experience gives us both challenges and opportunities to consider anew the depth of God's love for us. Sometimes we find ourselves what we think, man, this is beyond God's capacity to love. And we go through a hard season and we find that we were lifted through that. There was a force, a presence to lean upon, whether that came in the form of one-on-one God time or in community with others. So we might also think of growth, spiritual growth, as increasing the grasp that we have on God's love. We keep going back to love, love, love. Why is that so important? Our faith journey here describes movement toward a deepening of love for God and for other people. Why is that so important? Wherever we are on this journey, whether we're in this place of I believe in God, not so sure about Jesus, how do Jesus and God work? Or maybe we're in a place where we say, I get that Jesus is Lord. I don't fully understand what all that means, but I want to follow him. Or maybe we're in a place where we say, I've been following Jesus for a long time. He's an important part of my day, every day. Or maybe we say, there is nothing more central to my life than the person of Jesus Christ. My entire life is centered in him. I want to love like he loves. Why is this growing in love so, so, so important? Think about, across all of history, who are some of the most admired people who come to mind? And don't, not Jesus, because we're in a church and that's always a good answer on a Sunday. But aside from Jesus, who are some of the most admired figures across history? Just shout them out. Martin Luther, Abe Lincoln, there was another one here. Gandhi. Mother Teresa. Dr. King. So question, Gandhi, King, Martin Luther, Mother Teresa, I left somebody out. Abe Lincoln. Lincoln's been big this morning. And by the way, the only politician... No, I'm sorry, Winston Churchill got named at 9:15. But my question is, are these people who are most admired across history, are they less loving people? Or are they more loving people? I mean, they're more loving. So even outside the church, if we look at who has advanced history for good, it's been more loving people. It's how things work. So our desire is to grow in love for God and love for other people. Mentioned, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, this faith bit. Some of you have a Fitbit, the thing on your wrist that keeps track of all the good things that you do for your health. And so we're going to be handing out faith bits next week. Now, don't get your hopes up. We don't have a deal with Apple. They're going to be a rubber band. But the idea is that it will prompt us to consider what are the things that we're doing to grow spiritually, to grow in love for God and for others. And then we'll have an assessment that you can do on your own. You don't turn it in. But it'll help you see, what are the things that you could do here at Atonement? What are we offering this fall that'll help you grow in love for God and for others? What are the things we can do here? What are the things that you can do on your own? God bless you. So growth is expected. And I have the slide of reconciliation is practiced. I'm going to just read the first part of this. We discern between sin and difference of opinion or disagreement. In our relationships with each other, we hold ourselves and one another to the high standard of God's forgiveness of us. Reconciliation is mutual. It involves openness and honesty, forgiveness offered, and forgiveness received. The other words are important too, but I'm going to leave you to read those on your own. That first sentence is important. Sometimes what we think is sin, what we consider sin, is really just variance or difference of opinion. And we can amplify variance or difference of opinion, and we can demonize those who demonstrate variance or difference of opinion. It seems like we lack the skill and perhaps even lack the will to practice reconciliation. I mean, why would we? You just move on, right? Doesn't Jesus even say, shake the dust off your feet? Well, when our rearview mirror is filled with the people who used to be in our lives, it gets kind of lonely. It gets kind of lonely. Why is it that reconciliation is so difficult? I think it's because we see it as a sign of weakness. We don't want to appear weak. We don't want to, in our words, let someone get away with it, whatever the it is. And what we mean when we say, well, I don't want someone to get away with it, what we mean is they need to pay for hurting me. They need to pay. Well, how much? And who decides? How long in the penalty box for a sin against us? I've been using the hockey metaphor this morning. I'm here for you, Doug. Is it a 2-minute minor? Is it a 5-minute major for fighting? Is it 10-minute misconduct? Is it a game misconduct? Is it a suspension? How long in the penalty box for sinning against us? And let's just say that we could decide on how long it needs to be and extract that penalty for that long and no longer. What assurance do we have that the rightness of that penalty will be accepted by the other? I mean, it's not like they signed on for it. If they could sign on for it, you probably wouldn't have issues to begin with. So usually what we end up with is a war of attrition. We're not really getting even. We're getting a little bit ahead, and then boom, 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 and you know how it goes. It doesn't seem to be a very future-oriented way. There is another way. Jesus has an entirely different economy. It's the economy of reconciliation. Jesus is always, always, always reconciling. Always. I was a salesman before I went to seminary. And when you go through sales training, you hear stuff like, always be closing. And what that means is you're always looking for some kind of commitment from the other person to advance the business relationship. And I'll tell you, at this point in my life, being around people who are always closing is exhausting. Sometimes I like just being where we are. But what would it be like if we as a church were people who were always reconciling? Always be reconciling. What does that look like? Jesus gives really clear instruction here. So much of what he says is allegory and parable and metaphor and not readily apparent because we're living in a different time and place. But this is just straight up instruction, how to. And before we get into the details of that, there are a couple of things that you won't find in this. You won't find anything in here about fault finding. And you won't find anything in here about deflection or defensiveness. What you will find is a goal, and the goal is a restored relationship. It's all about that. It's not about scoring points or keeping points from being scored against you. It's about a restored relationship. That's the goal. Why? Because Jesus is always reconciling, and that's because that's the best way he wants that for us as well. So how does that happen? Say that it's not just a matter of variance or difference of opinion. Someone has really hurt you in some way, and they may or may not know it. So you go to them, as Jesus prescribes, by just the two of you. You don't want to call them out in a public place, add embarrassment to all the other things. You say, you know, you might not have realized it at the time, but here's something that happened, and here's how I experienced that, and you're important to me. I don't want to let that be between us. And Jesus says sometimes that alone will do it. You're good. Hey, I didn't know. Wow, really sorry. Sing kumbaya, go have a cup of coffee, you're good. Other times, he says, it's not enough. There's something in the relationship that makes it so you can't really hear each other. And so if you're going to be restored, you're going to need someone to help that restoration. So you bring other people along. You bring other people along not so that they can gang up on this poor, unsuspecting other, but so that they can help you hear each other in the most generous and constructive way. And he's got some other steps, and you know, it's eventually gets to a point where, hey, if that doesn't work, then really what you have is you have to treat them like they're a Gentile or a tax collector, which is outside the community, just recognizing things for what they are. But what's Jesus' interest in Gentiles and tax collectors? He reaches out to them. So always, always, always be reconciling. I want to talk just briefly about the difference between reconciliation and forgiveness, because it's important. Reconciliation is like forgiveness multiplied. So it's mutual. I'm forgiving you, you're forgiving me. There's mutuality in that. But we don't always have the option for mutuality. Sometimes the person who has sinned against us is no longer living. There can't be mutuality. Sometimes that person lives far, far away. They might not be aware that they've hurt us. They might not even acknowledge that they've hurt us. And so forgiveness then on our own is the limit of what we can control. We can still extend forgiveness. Why? Because it's the only path toward a possible relationship there and clearing out the clutter in our own lives. So forgiveness matters. We practice that too. Richard Rohr is a Franciscan priest and author. We quote him sometimes around here because several of the staff receive his devotion every day. And this past week, it was all on forgiveness. In the middle of the week, Wednesday, Thursday, thereabouts, he made these observations about forgiveness. He says, when we forgive, we experience goodness three ways. When we forgive another, we choose their goodness over their faults. Everyone has goodness. Everyone has faults. At least everyone I've ever met. And so when we forgive, we're choosing their goodness over their faults. When we forgive, the goodness of God is flowing through us. And when we forgive, we find that our capacity for goodness is greater than we realized. It may even surprise us. We practice reconciliation. Amen.